Hi, I'm Bob Moon. Credit cards. Seems we can't live without them, but can we live with them?
I've never made a late payment. I never came close to abusing it or really even using it. They're, at the end of the day, they're the ones making the decision.
And when so many folks in town are out of work, what do? Hold an event to help them. But if there are no jobs, what good is it?
It pacifies the public and it makes it possible for them to have hope where there is no hope.
Do you feel pacified?
No.
We hear from some job hunters in Youngstown, Ohio. Plus, the economy's bleak. We're all looking for ways to make extra cash.
But then I learned about Jeff Paul's shortcuts to internet millions, and I'm now making, you know, $11 billion a minute.
Yes, not all work-at-home opportunities are created equal, but believe it or not, they're not all scams either. That story and more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Many of us have been feeling the pain from our plastic recently. Our credit cards have been flat out canceled, interest rates hiked, and ugh, those fees. But just when the public's feeling pretty angry at the financial sector, this week the president took an interest in all that interest. I'm Bob Moon, in for Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers.
We'll hear what happened when the president sat down with the credit card companies in a few minutes. But first, got any credit card horror stories? Or maybe just something that's left you feeling a little, shall we say, taken advantage of? Or perhaps you've suddenly lost that best friend you've grown accustomed to having right there in your back pocket. Producer Eve Troe hit the streets of Los Angeles at lunchtime this week to hear how regular folks feel about their plastic these days.
I do like my credit cards.
It's great if you're responsible. Let's just put it that way.
But they do try to take advantage of the people that aren't watching out for themselves.
I missed one payment with a credit card. It just slipped my mind, and my interest rate shot. It was good like 10% in a day.
You'll find a lot of people who are angry at their credit card companies because they're paying 18 or 20 or 20.
Trying to avoid the 22%.
Raising it to 32 on late payments.
My Amex was unilaterally closed. My Bank of America card, the limit was cut in half.
The problem, too, is that you need credit to get credit. So if they're closing your credit cards, that in and of itself, I think, lowers your credit score.
I've never made a late payment. I never came close to abusing it or really even using it. They're, at the end of the day, they're the ones making the decision.
I was pretty loyal to the credit card company, and I should have been cut some slack, I think.
If we lived in different times, those people in the town square might have taken up logs and torches and headed toward the credit card company offices. But this being 2009, they call consumer groups to complain. And those complaints have become enough of a roar that America might see some credit legislation pass for the first time in a long time. So says Linda Sherry. She's director of national priorities for a group called Consumer Action. I asked her about the major credit card gripes her office has passed along to Washington.
I think that the problems that we really have are when the balances shoot up overnight from the automatic extensions of credit, interest rates and minimum payments that double, and the large penalty fees in the industry nowadays. There's just no way that consumers can really count on their next minimum payment being a certain amount so that they can budget for it, because it could be changed at the drop of a hat, and then they wouldn't know what they owed the next month, and maybe they wouldn't be able to afford it either.
One of the people we spoke to on the street was wondering about the idea that if they close your account, that's going to ding your credit score. Is that true? If the credit card company closes your account, that hurts your overall credit score?
Mm-hmm. Smart consumer that you found on the street there, yes. When an account is closed by a bank or a financial institution, it's almost as if the cardholder has done something wrong, so the account is being closed because it's not at the consumer's request. Overall, people who manage their credit carefully are not going to be subjected to these wild swings on their credit scores. But some of the things that the card companies are doing right now, we think are problematic. And one is, you know, slashing the credit limits to the point where you're very close to your existing balance. We understand why the companies are doing it. They're doing it to basically pull back and contract the amount of credit that's out there so that they can better manage their accounts. But the way they're doing it is extremely ham-handed. expanded. They're getting people so close to their existing balance that they may indeed get a ding on their credit score. And if other things are going on in that person's life, other accounts are having any kind of problems, as it were, these things all together can cause quite a decline in a consumer's credit score and thereby make it very difficult for them to get credit in the future.
And it's tough to live without a credit card these days, renting a car or even buying a ticket for the New York subway.
People do need credit cards, and I'm looking to the day when we get back to more sane credit cards. Perhaps we need to accept the fact that we need to pay maybe a small annual fee every year in order to get a rate that we can rely on that isn't going to necessarily change, you know, when the wind blows. So I think that there is a lot of room here for issuers to get together with consumer advocates and government regulators, et cetera, and design a new way of doing business, a way that gives rights to both consumers and allows the company to make a decent profit, if maybe not the gross profits they've been making off of fee income for the past decade.
And is it your sense that the climate is indeed changing here toward the consumer?
Oh, most definitely. To have the president talking about the need for substantive regulation and legislation for credit cards, this is a totally refreshing place to be.
Hmm. Linda Sherry is Director of National Priorities at Consumer Action. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And as we just heard our consumer advocate mention, President Obama applied to the credit card companies this week, in a manner of speaking. In part, he was seeking some relief for the rest of us. The president held discussions at the White House with execs from Visa, MasterCard, and other banks that issue credit cards. Those folks have long opposed legislation known as the Credit Card Holders Bill of Rights, designed to limit charges that many consumers think are unfair. If you feel like weighing in on the issue, now might be the right time to demand some slack from your own members of Congress. In the past, banks have successfully defeated such bills. But as Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports, this year could be different.
Congressional Democrats have pushed stronger protections for credit card users ever since they took control of the House in 2006. This week, the House Financial Services Committee approved Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney's Credit Card Holders Bill of Rights for the second session in a row. Texas Republican Jeb Hensarling, who's opposed the bill just as long as Maloney has pushed it, grudgingly praised the sponsor.
Although I disagree with her legislation, she has been quite tenacious in its advocacy, and I certainly yield to her on the point that the momentum is in her favor.
A day later, President Obama added to that momentum by telling credit card executives at a White House meeting he wants limits on what he calls abusive and unfair practices.
I trust that those in the industry who want to act responsibly will engage with us in a constructive fashion, and that we're going to be able to get this done in short order.
The Bush administration resisted previous efforts to impose restrictions on credit card policies, but candidate Obama campaigned on reform. Consumer advocate Jerry Detweiler at Credit.com expects the president's support to be a game changer.
We've got the atmosphere for change, and so I anticipate an even greater result from what's going on right now in Congress.
Also fueling the momentum is the government's trillion-dollar bailout of the banking industry. Ben Woolsey at CreditCards.com says taxpayers figure all that money should have bought them some cheaper credit.
Instead of that happening, they've been seeing their rates increase and their credit lines go down, so there's a real disconnect in the mind of the American consumer. I think that really has added quite a bit of ammunition to these legislative initiatives. I think they'll definitely pass.
Even though the Federal Reserve will impose similar rules by the middle of next year, reformers in Congress and now the White House are pushing for earlier changes. The House is expected to pass a bill next week. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers. And by Constant Contact, helping more than 250,000 small businesses and nonprofits succeed using email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Constant Contact, a smart way to reach your customers. American Public Media presents the Poetry Radio Project. You can hear conversations with poets about the economy, music, cooking, and more at americanpublicmedia.org/poetry.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Time now for The Straight Story with our own financial expert, Chris Farrell. And, well, what do you know? Seriously, what do you know? What do we all know when it comes to financial literacy? And how are we ever going to learn all we need to know on the subject when it's all so confusing? Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke talked about this the other day, and maybe he should have included some of his own government colleagues in his call for clarity in our financial lives.
The first line of defense, undoubtedly, is a well-informed consumer. Consumers who know what questions to ask are considerably better able to find the financial products and services that are right for them.
Well, how can you argue with that? Well, Chris Farrell is here. And Chris, I understand you have a beef with that. What could possibly be wrong with financial literacy? I mean, we do it every weekend here on Marketplace Money.
I think financial literacy is wonderful. But I have a minor complaint. Do you think that the regulators could kind of agree on what is financial literacy? Let me give you an example. Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC. So Zvi Bode, he's one of my favorite professors, finance professor, Boston University. He's at an economics conference, and he goes around and he interviews economic professors with the Securities and Exchange Commission's definition of savings and investing for the individual. And he reads it out. Every single economist gives the SEC a failing grade on financial literacy. And the reason is they all go, that's not savings and investing. That's not the definition. What are they talking about? Savings is simply the dollar you earn today that you put aside and you don't consume it.
Well, I've got to cut my way through all of these terms in the credit card agreements and all of that sort of thing. And how am I supposed to know if they don't know?
Right. So that's part of it. Look, financial literacy is important, and people do need to take responsibility for their money. But I think it's the other part of Bernanke's speech that was much more important, and that was the regulatory side, because there's many things you and I just can't do. What I would emphasize is less the financial literacy and more good regulation.
So you're saying we need somebody to protect us from all of that vague stuff that nobody really knows about.
It's all the vague stuff like double billing cycle, which no one can really define. That's one of the examples Bernanke uses. And there's all these things. And, you know, we need simplicity. We need transparency. Consumers need to be able to make simple comparisons because people are smart. But, you know, they're working hard. They're trying to raise families, volunteer in their communities. We're all trying to do these things. We don't have hours and hours to spend trying to become more and more financially literate compared to the financial institutions. So the regulation is really important. And by the way, Ben, could you sit down with the head of the SEC and come to some kind of agreement about what is savings and what's investing?
Well, thank you, Chris. I appreciate you being so illuminating about all these very hard to decipher topics.
Thanks a lot.
And Chris, you'll be back in just a bit for some more Getting Personal.
Okay.
Need a little extra cash to pay those credit card bills? Well, maybe you've seen ads like these and thought,
You don't need to know anything about computers or the internet to make money. It's fast.
It's easy. And it works.
Scams or golden opportunities? We'll have the skinny in a moment. Plus, are clouds gathering when it comes to cybersecurity for consumers? Next up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon, in for Tess Vigeland. So it's way past midnight. You can't sleep. I always raid the fridge first and then pad out to the living room to see what's on TV. But on so many channels at that hour, a lot of the regular programming has been replaced by this.
So if you're excited to learn how to make as much money as you want with 10 free website businesses of your very own, then don't touch that remote control.
Yeah, and I'll bet you even waive the shipping and handling fee. Get-rich-quick ads like that have proliferated on TV and the Internet for years, but more and more of them have cropped up during and possibly due to this recession. And some have shifted their target audience from stay-at-home moms and insomniacs to just laid-off anybodies. But wait, there's more from Marketplace's Sean Cole.
Our guide through the jungle of work-at-home programs is Melissa Yaros. She's a full-time executive assistant in Chicago, but she's always looking to earn a little extra.
Yeah, for vacation time or Christmas or whatever the need might be.
And when her husband's fire alarm installation company started failing late last year, the need got greater. So she's been on the hunt, weeding through a thicket of work-at-home programs that make extravagant promises.
You know, make $3,000 a day while you sleep or whatever.
Did you ever see any of those late-night infomercials on TV?
Oh, yeah, I've had a couple of insomniac nights where they've had a couple of young girls showing all their cleavage and enticing all the men that were still.
Welcome to beautiful Southern California. I'm Stacey Hayes.
And I'm Carmen Palumbo.
Today we're at one of the most...
This is probably the reigning work-at-home infomercial. Jeff Paul's Shortcuts to Internet Millions.
And listen to this. Even though it's an internet system, you don't need to know anything about computers or the internet to make money. It's fast.
It's easy. And it works.
But how does it work? All I can tell is that the program costs $39.95. Jeff Paul never responded to my email, or the fax I was told to send. And when I looked at his website with Allison Southwick at the Better Business Bureau...
It's kind of a visual overload here. Everything's exploding and colorful and coming at me.
Including a lot of red flags, she says, waving violently.
Money back guarantee. It's as easy as sending email.
Southwick says customers have complained to the Bureau about this program, saying, for instance, that they can't get their money back. And she expects to hear a lot more complaints this year about a lot of programs, because the Jeff Pauls of the world know their audience.
During their infomercial, I think there was one guy who said, yeah, I just got laid off from my job.
I got laid off, and not just me, but everyone I worked with.
But then I learned about Jeff Paul's Shortcuts to Internet Millions, and I'm now making, you know, $11 billion a minute. So they definitely are playing off of the economy, and they're trying to speak to people, you know, who've been laid off, who are up at 2, 3 in the morning.
Thankfully, Melissa Yaros is really careful about vetting these programs, and she's not even looking to get rich quick.
No, I think, you know, with some hard work and working smart, that you can make a decent income.
Which is exactly what Vicky Sace is trying to do. For a little less than a year, she's been building a home business around eBay called Vicky's Ventures.
Actually, it's Vicky's Ventures Incorporated.
She started off selling ebooks on eBay. Then she wrote her own book on how to use eBay.
Called Auction Payday Kids Play.
And she says her sales are a good measure of how the economy is doing.
In the fall, I was selling primarily cookbooks and that kind of book. But pretty much since Christmas, more than 90% of everything I'm selling right now is geared toward how can I make money from home.
But selling ebooks doesn't exactly turn your computer into an ATM. Sace might make $1,000 one month and no dollars the next. It seems like the only reliable work-at-home job you'll find online is an actual job. And Melissa Yaros says you can find them on flexjobs.com.
I heard about flexjobs actually through LinkedIn. They make sure that they're all legitimate jobs and that there aren't any of those scammers just wanting to take your money.
FlexJobs is basically a classified listing of telecommuting jobs, anything from part-time sales gigs to VP of a company. Job searchers pay a subscription fee. Sarah Sutton Fell, who runs FlexJobs, says the primary audience used to be stay-at-home moms.
But in the last 4 to 6 months, that's changed quite a bit, and our audience has broadened massively. People who would have never previously considered telecommuting or work-from-home jobs are very much looking towards it as a viable professional option.
And thus, FlexJobs has changed its marketing.
Using terms such as part-time and second jobs and trying to get the word out to, you know, people who are unemployed.
Plus, the actual number of jobs on FlexJobs is up 40%. Fell says employers might be realizing that telecommuters cost less.
Have you thought of putting together an infomercial for Flex Jobs? Like, Flex Jobs, come online and do something somewhat normal.
We've actually been approached to do those things.
Have you really?
Oh, a few times, too. And actually, no joke, probably after this airs, we'll be contacted again.
And there are only 3 seconds left in this radio story, so don't delay. In Boston, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace Money. Call now.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Marketplace Money is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
Here's a phenomenon that you might have trouble imagining. Why would some of America's top college grads be eager to head for some of the toughest classrooms in the country? It's part of a program called Teach for America. Those accepted teach full-time for at least 2 years in an inner-city or far-flung community. And it's very competitive. They earn teacher salaries and get some federal student loans forgiven. Many continue with teaching, but others use it as a stepping stone, a graduate school or a more lucrative career in another field. But since jobs have vaporized for new college grads, Teach for America is looking more like a great opportunity in and of itself. Reporter Sally Herships found applications to the program are sky high.
Teach for America is one tough gig. Donna Foote should know. She spent a year following 4 of the program's teachers at Locke, an inner-city school in L.A. She wrote a book about it. The idea came, she says, from visiting a friend's classroom at the school.
And there was my friend at the front of the classroom with her fingers up for each syllable of words as simple as cat. So it would be k-at, cat. And this was not a remedial ninth-grade English class. This was ninth-grade English at Locke High School.
It's difficult work, and the pay a teacher's is low. But nonetheless, Foote says Teach for America only wants to hire future leaders.
The secret sauce to Teach for America is this premium put on human capital. They want the best and the brightest on the bus, and they know where they're going.
This year, Foote says, it's harder than ever to get in. Applicant numbers are at record levels, 35,000 job seekers for just 6,000 or 7,000 spots. 11% of all Ivy League seniors applied.
It is tough. 25% of the graduating class at Spelman, 15% at Princeton and Yale, 14% at Harvard.
Notre Dame grad Patrick Vassell made the cut a couple years back. The political science major wasn't sure teaching was the best career for him, but now his apartment is well-stocked with Dr. Seuss books and boxes of macaroni for art projects. His days are spent teaching special education to fourth graders.
So if we count by 4, Cyan, so just like he's separating them, right? So we've separated. Oh, what are you counting by, Jamal?
I'm counting by 3s, like 3, 6, 9, 12.
Vassell says while it's the most challenging thing he's ever done, the program is also an investment in his future.
What does it mean to have this on your resume?
It's tremendous.
But
there's far easier things to do in the world to polish your resume than to commit to teaching 2 years in, you know, an urban or rural underprivileged school. There's faster ways to move up whatever ladder you're trying to.
Teach for America, Vassell says, is more than just a bullet point on your resume.
It means good things for your future.
Donna Foote again. Employers know, she says, program grads gain skills that can be applied almost anywhere.
Achievement, perseverance, critical thinking.
It's these skills that attract universities and employers like Google to take the program's grads. David Stanley is a recruitment director at Teach for America. He says applicants were rising long before the job market soured.
I don't think that this is necessarily a passing fad, and I think people are really kind of outraged when people are losing their mortgages and their houses and all these things are happening, that education is really the way to get back to the roots of all that.
Stanley says Teach for America is taking advantage of its growing popularity. One of the program goals, he says, is to get 100 alumni into political office by the year 2010. It's not just about the future, though. teacher Patrick Vassell is also focused on today.
The payoff is right now that we have a job, because so many people don't and are or are losing them very quickly.
But Teach for America recruiter David Stanley says right now people have public welfare on their minds. The Peace Corps says their applications are up 16%, and Teach for America is on track to double its workforce by next year. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
Now for your money questions, we're getting personal, and here again is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Bob.
Chris, let's take a call from Karen in Rochester, New York. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
So what's your question for Chris today?
Well, I went back to graduate school this past semester, and I'm going part-time. I applied for a federal Stafford loan, and because I'm working full-time, I only needed the amount of tuition. And the amount is $6,000. However, I received almost $15,000. And I called to inquire about this big check that I received, and I was told that I received the maximum amount, and I'm free to do with it what I wish.
Great!
I do have a credit card balance, and I'm wondering if it might be smart to apply this 6.8% educational loan to a nearly $9,000 credit card balance on three cards that range from 4 to 15% APR.
Hmm. Chris, what does she do? Take the money and run here?
Part of the answer is, from a purely financial point of view, it'd make a lot of sense to take this loan, which has a lower interest rate, pay off the credit cards, and then just continue to pay it off because you're going to save money over time. But here's my warning bell going off. One of the ways people got into trouble in the 2000s was lenders would lend to us more than we needed, whether it was student loans, home equity loans, mortgages. They're always willing to lend to us more than we need.
And it's still not free money, is it? Huh?
And it's still not free money. And that's how people ended up taking too much debt. And I really have become a fundamentalist about this. You're working. You don't need to borrow the extra money. You got to pay down the credit card debt. You're probably going to attack that anyway. You're not going to save that much on interest as it is. You borrow what you need, and you just refuse the rest. You don't develop that habit. It may not be, in the short term, the financially smartest move, but long term, I think it's the way you want to run your life.
Karen, something tells me that's what you were thinking.
I have always been frugal, and I've always been one who believes, probably from my upbringing, that you don't ever get anything for nothing.
Right.
So my warning bells did flash, so thank you for that.
Pretty tempting, though, isn't it, Karen?
It's very tempting, since the amount of my credit card debt and the amount of the check I have in hand are almost exactly the same.
I know. But you're still going to be in debt.
I am still going to be in debt, yes.
It's really not paying off the credit cards. It's just taking one form of debt for another. Obviously, you've been frugal. You don't need to deal with this. But just for other people to think about, you can't discharge student loans in bankruptcy. You can always walk away from your credit cards if you had to, right? Now, you're not going to do that. That's not this kind of a situation. But the reason why I'm raising it is I just don't even think the risk-reward ratio is there. It just doesn't make sense from a risk perspective. You know, borrow what you need. You'll just address the credit cards because you're continuing to work, and you'll pay it down.
So, Karen, stay frugal.
Thank you.
Next, we have an email from Tanya in Arlington, Virginia. She's thinking about a refi on her home since rates are so low right now. Her mortgage is privately held, Chris, and I take it that means that the old owner of the house sold it to her directly.
Right. It's called seller financing.
The interest rate is at more than 6%. She's wondering how this loan impacts her credit score, since private loans aren't reported to the credit reporting agencies. Would it be better for her credit score and her chances of refinancing if that mortgage was held by a bank rather than a private individual?
Well, she's absolutely right. It's not reported to the credit reporting bureaus, the agencies, so it doesn't factor into her credit score. Now, she has an auto loan, a credit card loan, you know, all the kinds of loans that we have, and she's been paying off those debts on time, then she'll have a good credit score.
Does it have an outsize effect on your credit score, a mortgage?
It has a big effect because it's a big debt. It's one that comes up every month. And therefore, if you miss payments, it really does stand out. So, yeah, the mortgage is particularly important in terms of the credit score. It's one of our longest debts. And one of the things that, you know, is important to your credit score is the history, your history payment. And so a mortgage can be almost a foundation of your payment history.
Well, if you have a question and you'd like our 2 cents, give us a call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, M-O-N-Y. Or you can write to us. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. We'll be back later in the show with more Getting Personal. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Okay, so we heard earlier from consumers about their not-so-fond feelings for credit card companies. Of course, they're not all bad. In the U.S., some banks have tried to play good guy with credit cards that deposit a small percent of your spending into a retirement or savings account for you. In Italy, one bank has a new product that it hopes will lend it some much-needed positive spin. It's got a, well, very ethical-sounding name, and it's making some charities happy. But as Megan Williams reports from Rome, there's also an air of cheap publicity.
At the historic Palazzo Venezia in downtown Rome, a high-end fundraiser is in full swing. The event is to raise awareness for the lack of official birth registration for more than 50 million kids born in Africa each year. Without birth certificates, the children are at greater risk of disappearing into slavery and exploitation. The Italian organization Sant'Egidio heads up the campaign. And its main sponsor is Italy's second biggest bank, UniCredit. But what makes UniCredit support more than a flavor of the month donation is that its commitment to the campaign is built into one of its products, a credit card.
We call it an ethical credit card. When the customer uses it, part of the sum he pays is devoted to charity.
Head of retail marketing for UniCredit, Frederick Goetman, says for every purchase customers make with the card, 0.3% of the total goes towards a cause, like registering African kids at birth, a donation the bank makes, not the customer. UniCredit introduced the card a few years ago as a niche product, but it's now more popular than its mainstay credit card.
Well, we basically told the branches, stop selling the traditional and just sell this one. So the vast majority of what we're selling is now ethical.
That's good news for Mario Marazziti, spokesperson for the campaign to register kids at birth. He says he prefers the longer-term commitment to one-off donations.
I think it's a good proposal for the times of crisis we are in, because in my opinion we have to create a structural relationship between the first world and the third world, and not just to leave it to charity.
Last year, through its ethical credit card, UniCredit raised $2 million. That's money Marazziti is happy to tap into. But as critics point out, ethical is a big word for a credit card that donates such a tiny percentage of its profits to charity, an amount that's also a drop in the bucket compared to, say, bank executive bonuses. UniCredit's Frederick Goetman agrees.
That's true. Many people make more than that. On the other hand, it's not a good reason not to do something.
Nor, say skeptics, is it good reason not to do more.
In Rome, I'm Megan Williams for Marketplace Money.
Well, no matter how ethical your credit card company is, you still have to be careful when it comes to paying that bill online, because you never know who's out there.
It requires us to think about security a little differently and maybe a little bit more carefully when you're putting all that data in someone else's hands.
Getting your head out of the clouds when it comes to your internet security. Next up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We'll be right back. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Tess Vigeland. Earlier, you heard how the organization Teach for America may be doubling its workforce. But of course, you don't have to look too hard to find the opposite trend. Take Youngstown, Ohio. 30 years ago, it was a thriving steel town. Today, unemployment hovers around 14%. Marketplace's Amy Scott passed through Youngstown recently and talked to some of the locals.
In Youngstown's Chevrolet Center, out of work Ohioans mill about on a covered ice hockey rink. The event is called a lifeline to Valley workers. Unemployment in the Mahoning Valley has about doubled in the last year. Government agencies, credit unions, and trade schools are here offering assistance.
We offer associate degrees in business administration, IT, and healthcare.
Michael Lyons represents National College. Enrollment has more than doubled since last year.
I think people are starting to say, okay, I have to reinvent myself. I have to put myself in a better position to move forward, because you can't stay still forever.
Billy Roberts is trying to move forward. He worked a crane at Severstal Steel for 20 years. He's been laid off about 6 months now. He's looking at training programs in business or communications.
I'm a high school soccer coach, and you know, I run a couple soccer clubs, so I've done some of that type of stuff on the side, working with people, communications and stuff. So I feel fairly confident if it was something I could get into doing that. Then that's something you don't have to worry about breaking your back, physical work, so you can work a little bit later in your life.
It's looking like Roberts will have to work longer than he planned. He has a pension at the steel mill, but after watching steelworkers lose their pensions and health care over the years, he's not counting on it. Being out of work has set back his savings.
I got a little bit late start in life, so I was looking at going to have to probably work till 65 or 66 anyhow, but losing almost a year's work, that's a tough one.
The idea of reinvention isn't that appealing to William Warren. At 61 years old, all he wants is a job.
I'm not looking to go to school. What I want to go to school for, I want some cash right now.
Warren worked at Indilex Aluminum in nearby Girard for 38 years. The plant closed last year. He's getting by on unemployment benefits for now, but he's looking for work to tide him over until he can start drawing his pension next year.
Everybody's saying that they're not hiring everywhere I've been going. There just isn't any real jobs out here right now. And there's more people that are out of work than jobs being offered.
What is being offered here is help. Help finding food and clothes and avoiding foreclosure. Mary Jo Earl is a loss mitigation negotiator for First Place Bank, which means if you're behind on your mortgage, she's the one who can cut you a deal. Traffic is slow when I stop by her table, but she says people really open up at events like these.
They'll tell you if they're delinquent, if they're current, they're in foreclosure. They'll tell you, you know, I make X amount of dollars. I didn't think that people would do that in such a public place, but they do. They're so scared and, you know, want so much help that they don't care.
Earl says sometimes the job gets her down.
You hear a lot of stories and you think there's just no way that there could be this much bad luck in the world. But then when you finally get to the point where you can actually help somebody, that kind of turns it around for you. Because if you can help somebody stay in their home, it gives you a good feeling.
There are a lot of people she can't help. If a customer is out of work and has no income, the only option may be foreclosure. Marty Nickerson is in that position. He drives trucks for a living, or did. He's been out of work for a year.
So I was looking to see if there was any possibility of getting into any type of schooling or anything of that such.
And you find anything?
Not really. This is a basic, what you would call an pacification job fair. It pacifies the public and it makes it possible for them to have hope where there is no hope.
Do you feel pacified?
No. Not I.
That skepticism may help explain the low turnout for the event. Organizers had expected 6,000 people. Officials say just over 4,000 showed up. Or maybe it was an event going on in a neighboring county, a real job fair. In Youngstown, Ohio, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com/new offers. Marketplace Money is supported by SaveAndInvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at SaveAndInvest.org.
Okay, we're back with more Getting Personal. Chris, ready for more questions?
Absolutely.
Well, first we have a basic question on how FDIC insurance works for your bank accounts. Now, you may have heard or seen stories lately that the federal agents have been taking over banks and the FDIC team literally waits outside until the bank closes on a Friday, and then they go in and all the employees are assigned a federal counterpart, basically. Dan in Minnesota wonders how that impacts the customers, say when they walk in on Monday after the takeover. Here's what he asks. If my bank fails, what do I need to show the FDIC to collect the insurance? Will my electronic statements do, or will I need to have paper? Chris, is there anything like what he's describing involved here? Does the customer really have to prove what he or she had in the bank at the time of the takeover?
Absolutely not. It's not like the insurance policy we have on our cars or our health. It's a little bit like saying, so we had this bank, and it was Chris Farrell Bank, and I blow it, and the FDIC comes in, and it becomes the Bob Moon Bank. They changed the name, but everything else remains the same.
Yeah, but if I take over, I'm raising all the fees, Chris.
That's another story. So again, as a customer, it really doesn't matter. Now, as a country, as taxpayers, there's a lot of things to be concerned about. But so long as you're under the $250,000 limit and you are fully insured, fully backstopped by the FDIC, that's probably the better word to use, you're fine.
But when we say a federal counterpart, Chris, does that mean that it's somebody different who takes over at the teller window? What if you like Nancy at the teller window?
Well, the odds are Nancy at the teller window is still going to be there. Now, if there's a merger and one bank's taking over another bank with the help of the FDIC, you know, eventually they're going to knit together their workforces and they may downsize.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times, the tellers, the employees, they remain the same. The changes are on senior management.
Okay. And we have a call from Tim in Nashville now. Hi, Tim. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine. Thank you.
So what's your question for Chris today?
Well, I need to decide whether or not to take a job offer. I currently have a secure job in affordable Nashville, and I'm being offered a less secure job in expensive Boulder.
Now, why would you take that?
The reason it's less secure is it's a term position that would end in 2011, although the intent would be for it to become permanent if the economy does well, but no guarantees. Would pay about $10,000 a year more, but most of that would probably just get eaten up in living expenses.
Boy, I think I hear the answer here between the lines, but I'm interested in what you have to say, Chris.
To me, it's weighing what's the long-term career return from making this move. If you get 2 years in the mountains, Boulder's beautiful, but that's basically what you get, and your standard of living is probably even going to decline a little bit, at least as far as things like rental and food and all that, I don't see why you'd make the move. But if it turns out this could be one of those shifts that really opens up the job market for you or a career opportunity, something you really want to do, then I'd lean toward it. And then the financial question is, how much savings will I have at the end of this period of time in case things don't work out?
Chris, you didn't ask him if he skis.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are a lot of non-financial reasons to make the move, but, it has to make sense financially for us, too, you know.
Good luck, Tim.
Okay. Well, thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
You know, Bob, it's nice to hear, though, about someone who's weighing a job opportunity, thinking about that risk as opposed to being worried about a layoff.
Yeah, really. And one more, though most of us are done with our taxes for 2008, never hurts to start thinking about 2009, right?
You know, I talk about yourself. I'm not thinking about it at least another week or so, okay?
Okay, well, I try not to think about it even during tax time. Martina in Ballston Spa, New York, says the amount of taxes withheld from her paycheck has gone down. That means more money for her now, of course, but won't she owe more next April 15th, Chris?
Well, what it is it's a tax credit. It's the make-work-pay tax credit, And the way that you get the money, which I believe averaged out for an individual to what, about $10 a week, is companies automatically adjusted your withholding. It is a way of getting this tax credit, this refundable tax credit, into your checking account now in the hope that you'll spend it in order to help the economy out. The one trick to this whole thing, just check with the tax withholding tables. You just go right to the IRS, www.irs.gov, and they've got this website set up for you in order to check and make sure that you're fine in terms of the tax man when it comes to the withholding change.
And I think you want to check that out for yourself, because when April 15th rolls around next year, you're not going to be able to point to your employer and say, it's their fault.
Remember, as far as the company is concerned, they don't know if you're carrying a second job, a third job. So you just don't want to end up in a situation come April where you're going to owe money. Your employer's doing the right thing. It's up to you.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. Sorry to say that's all the time we have for Getting Personal in this week's show. But do let us know if we can help you out with your money questions. You can call and leave a voicemail at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, M-O-N-Y. We take questions by email, too. Just go to the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Thanks, Chris, for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. So we all know about Google by now, and I'm slowly absorbing this fascination with Twitter. And then along come the clouds. That's the increasingly popular innovation that allows you to access all kinds of personal information through cyberspace, but it also could affect your online security. That's why a bunch of tech folk were discussing it at an online security conference in San Francisco this week. Declan McCullough was there. He's an editor with CNET, and he understands this concept behind storing your data on a cloud.
This is the idea that instead of using, say, Microsoft applications on our desktop, the ones that we all know and love, maybe, like Microsoft Word and Excel, we'll instead use applications like maybe Google Spreadsheets, Google Docs, Gmail, and keep our data out there on the internet in someone else's hands.
Well, that kind of thing seems to be gaining in popularity quite rapidly now. What does it mean for the average person, specifically those of us who aren't real familiar with the details of cybersecurity?
Well, if your data's on your laptop, we're talking tax returns, we're talking personal spreadsheets, the primary thing you have to be worried about is keeping your laptop patched, especially if you're running Microsoft Windows, and also making sure that you don't lose it at an airport or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of us have been worried about just sending simple emails across the internet, and we all know what antivirus and spyware protection has become. I just got through sending all my tax information out there to that mysterious place called cyberspace, and all I thought as I clicked the mouse was, okay, the IRS suggested this, it must be okay, right?
I don't know if I trust the government for cybersecurity tips, but this is another example. I mean, TurboTax, which is what I use, more and more of our tax data is being sent over the internet and kept in the cloud. More people are using TurboTax on the web than ever before, as opposed to downloading the software that you install on your computer. It's just kind of easier. But when you have your data on the web, instead of worrying about your laptop being stolen, you have to worry about your password being stolen. And so what this means is that you have to be much more careful about using, say, passwords that are difficult to guess. You have to sort of practice safe computing.
And we don't really think a lot about that because we've never had to. We figured it was safe and secure right in our hands.
Exactly right. This does change the way we have to think about security. And because the wonders of cloud computing is that if we're using some sort of web-based document management system like Google Docs, people use Facebook to post photos and videos as well, all this is being stored in the cloud. And I should mention, by way of digression, that this is much, much more common for folks, say, in high school and college now. The folks who are keeping data on their computer will be a dwindling bunch over time. But it requires us to think about security a little differently and maybe a little bit more carefully when you're putting all that data in someone else's hands.
But it seems to me that this goes way beyond posting a picture on Facebook, getting drunk at a party, as opposed to sending really personal information that could be very damaging if it got into somebody else's hands.
It's true. The thing about viruses and malware and all these...
Let me back you up here. I know antivirus. I know spyware. What's malware?
Oh, malware is a computer geek's term, and I apologize for using it. That's sort of an umbrella term. It covers all sorts of mal or bad software, including worms and viruses and spyware. All this malware that we hear about, for all of their problems, at least they can only affect one computer at a time. The problem is that if you have cloud computing, then if that's compromised, then you can have thousands or hundreds of thousands of people's data exposed all at once.
What about now? What are some of the basic things that people should do to avoid ID theft now? And were there specific products at this conference that have caught your eye?
Well, probably the most important thing is to practice safe computing. This means going to a site like download.com. You can find antivirus software there. There's something called Tech Tracker that'll make sure that your computer's up to date. But for the most part, it's do what you've already been doing, just a little more carefully. It's a dangerous world out there on the Internet.
Declan McCullough is an editor at CNET. Thank you very much for your insights.
Hope I helped.
Well, now that we've learned all kinds of things about Internet security, perhaps it's time to put it to good use. How about going online to buy an airline ticket? It's certainly a lot cheaper to fly these days. Many domestic and international fares have been slashed double digits compared to last year. For example, this week you can get an L.A. to New York ticket for less than $100. Almost feels like you're stealing from the airlines to take advantage of these deals, especially in today's brutal business climate. I can almost hear Tom Parsons from the travel site bestfares.com singing out, "Too bad, so sad."
Don't care today. I know I have an economic climate here in my pocket, and if somebody wants to fly me coast to coast for $158, I'm taking it.
Now, of course, fees keep going up. For example, just about all the airlines now charge to check even a first bag. But Tom's figured out a rather clever way to soften the sting.
If you check two bags a day, the average cost is $80. It's almost cheaper today to bring an extra person on with you, because there's so many airfares out there that run in that $78 or $98 range.
Think of it this way. You're buying the extra seat for the same cost, which at least lowers the fees for two bags. In fact, I wonder if you could even just belt another bag into that adjoining seat you bought. It's bound to be a lot quieter than that old lady who wants to tell you about her cats for the duration of the flight. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, home prices are down around the country, and you might hope the person putting the sticker price on yours uses lots of complex equations.
But, you know, frankly, it's more an art than it is a science.
Marketplace Money's senior producer is Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Tro. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can come back and join Tess Viglin here next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the Internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers.
American Public Media.